Hello and welcome to Displaced. I'm Grant Gordon.
And I'm Ravi Gurumurthy, and we're your co-hosts on the show. Displaced is a partnership between the International Rescue Committee, where Grant and I work, and Vox Media. And this is the podcast to listen to if you want to understand the global refugee crisis and how the nature of war is changing displacement.
Understanding the future of war is really crucial to understanding how people's lives will be impacted, why wars start, how they end, and what the solutions for wars are going to be.
In our last episode, we talked with Rob Malley, the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, about the conflicts to watch in 2019 and the underlying trends that are reshaping the nature of war.
This week, we're talking to Lauren DeJong-Schulman and Aaron Simpson, two of the three co-hosts of the Bombshell podcast, about how technology is changing the future of war. So think of autonomous weapons, artificial intelligence, cyber warfare. We're going to get into all of your worst nightmares this week.
Aaron's a defense academic turned executive who now works in the defense industry, and Lauren has held a range of senior staff positions at the National Security Council and the Department of Defense. A shout out to Radha Iyengar, the third co-host, who is stuck somewhere in the snow traveling and could not make it to this taping.
So yeah, I'm really interested to talk to the Bombshell crew because they come from a deep understanding of defense and national security, and often there's a danger of humanitarians just talking to other humanitarians. And I think we're going to get a really interesting insight into how the defense establishment thinks about autonomous weapons and cybersecurity, and therefore what the implications are for humanitarians.
Without further ado, Lauren and Aaron. Lauren and Aaron, thank you so much for being with us today on Displaced.
We are so excited to be here. This is actually our second podcast recording of the day, so we'll be even better.
Gaining practice.
Thanks for having us.
Yep.
So we're going to dive into the question of autonomous weapons, first of all. And when you say the word autonomous weapons, it probably conjures up the image of Terminator-style killer robots. Can you just first begin by telling us what are autonomous weapons and how significant are they?
I'm just going to also say it's a lot less threatening when you say the Terminator with a British accent.
That's true. Well, I don't know. Actually, from my perspective, I think British accents always sound more evil. It's like the Star Wars effect.
We are always the baddies in the film, so, you know.
Exactly. Aaron has a great explanation of autonomous weapons and autonomous systems that I'll turn over to her.
Well, I think the most important thing to think about with autonomous weapons is that they imply and require a delegation of authority, right? So there's any number of dumb or smart technologies that might enable that. But autonomous weapons are weapons that act essentially on their own in some fashion, right? So you might think about a landmine as an autonomous weapon. It's not smart. There's no fancy algorithms. There's no AI. There's almost not even really any software. But you've fully delegated the authority for that thing to detonate once somebody steps on it. That's a very different kind of worldview than we think about autonomous weapons in the 21st century. But I think it's a useful frame of reference for emphasizing the authority element, the delegation element, as opposed to all of the fancy software or AI systems that might go along with that.
And that's something I think that's important for us to think about. So we, on our podcast, Bombshell, we are process nerds. And we talk about that all the time, where the process of decision making and the people that are participating in it and the way that they tee issues up, those are all really important to matters of national security. Autonomous weapons is something that decision makers will grapple a lot with in terms of, like, do I feel comfortable with this? Am I okay with turning over my decision-making power to something else, whatever that may be, whether it may be a massive killer robot that we've never seen before or just a landmine? Those are really big issues to grapple with because it's effectively taking away power that a man or woman had and handing it over to a machine or a system that is not going to check in with you to say, hey, is this okay or not?
So that's a really helpful framework and underscores the core question of kind of like, when do you delegate? And from what you're seeing as autonomous weapons, either more advanced or kind of lower tech, as you were mentioning, become more prominent, are there a general set of rules or situations under which delegation is becoming increasingly common or becoming a standard?
I would say not yet. So, I mean, the U.S. is really, I want to say, just beginning to grapple with this. We've been working on this for a few years now, but there's a DoD directive that emphasizes human control, particularly for weapons release and related kind of weapons usage in these systems. So I don't think that we're seeing a great deal of delegation actually in any of our systems yet. So even when we think about some of the more sophisticated platforms, like maybe the Global Hawk, which is a high-altitude surveillance platform, or any of these other kind of very cool high-speed systems that seem to be, you know, flying on their own or robots working on their own, a lot of those are actually working with hard-coded, pre-programmed, whether they're waypoints or destination points for those systems. The platforms are not making decisions on their own just yet. So from the U.S. side, I don't think that we've seen very much full delegation. Some other countries, Russia, China, Israel, Iran, might be making some other decisions because they're trying to solve some other strategic problems or manpower problems or reliability issues within their own armed forces. But for the most part, I don't think we've seen a lot of delegation of authority specific with regards to weapons usage in any of these systems just yet.
And other circumstances under which displacement of human judgment by machines is obviously a good thing, or is there a case that ethical warfighting always requires some sort of human decision maker?
Oh, for sure. And I think that that's – it's sometimes useful to think about the ways in which we've offloaded some of these, if not decisions, at least assessments to machines already. You know, so if you think about Hunt for Red October, when you watch the, you know, the Jonesy and the sonar, you know, figuring out like whether there's a new submarine out there already, right? That's 40-year-old technology essentially at this point. And for the most part, we're pretty comfortable with that. The weapons release still remains, and the decision, what you identify that there's a bad guy nearby, what you do about that still remains a wholly human decision.
Yeah, I think one way to think about it, and this is such a layman's way to interpret it, so I apologize to any technologists who have a better way of describing it, but a lot of autonomous systems that we are comfortable with now tend to be ones that are telling us this is not a big deal. Don't do something. Or it's okay to not pay attention to this whale. Or it's okay to not pay attention to this thing that we don't really necessarily know what it is. So I guess obviously in Hunt for the Red October, that was not right. but for the most part, the delegation of authority we are most comfortable with, particularly in war fighting discussions, is don't do something now because this is not scary. This is not an adversary. This is not a threat. Pay attention to this stuff over here. And that involves more human judgment about whether or not you should be acting in some way.
I think as long as the question remains, is this a whale or not? I think we're all in safe territory. That's like all we're doing. If I'm understanding right, it seems like a distinguishing factor is whether autonomous weapons or technologies are being used to identify something versus whether they're being used to respond to something. And there's more comfort around identification, seemingly a little bit more discomfort if that's actually flagging you to potentially respond. But it's really the response category where it starts to become more of an ethical challenge.
Yeah, I think militaries are ultimately, at the end of the day, control freaks. And that autonomous systems are, like, they look really fascinating in movies. And it is absolutely right. They are paying attention to a lot of the issues and assumptions that go into them. But thinking through how those systems actually interact with the people that are in militaries and the concepts of operations, the instructions of how do we interact with as humans with those systems, those are all really important too. And the fact that humans in the military tend to be control freaks, I think, is an important factor for folks who are maybe a little more freaked out about autonomous systems to consider and pay attention to.
We started with Ravi's question about the Terminator taking over in his very lackadaisical British accent that intimidated nobody. But I think it's worth actually just kind of calling out, like, what are people afraid of when they're afraid of autonomous weapons? And with both of you kind of engaging in these conversations every day, not what are like the kind of movie-esque and cinematic concerns, but what are like the actual concerns that people are grappling with?
So one of my concerns, and this is much more of a personal perspective, I have spent a lot of my life dealing with engineers. I'm married to an engineer. I love engineers. Engineers are a vital part of our economy and our society. They have really different –
you're now
all
bound
that
to,
said.
I can tell you.
Yeah, the butt is coming.
Husband. My husband is listening. It's going to be fine. They have just really different assumptions about how a lot of things work and what – is valuable to them and what makes sense to them that is different than I, as a super not nerdy political science kind of person, have a really different viewpoint on. And so taking this as out of the warfighting category for a while, when I lived in Silicon Valley for a brief period of time, I talked to somebody who wanted to create kind of a Yelp type app that was pre-selecting and prioritizing certain kinds of restaurants based on their own value set, ones mm-hmm. that recycled and ones that use organic food. And I think they didn't like pork or something like that, not for any other reason. They just didn't like it. And I had conversations like that over and over again where the assumptions that engineers were making about the kind of systems that they were building that were purely based around their own personal experiences and preferences that did not make sense to me or would not be universally applicable. At the end of the day, these are all systems built by engineers who may be incredibly smart and reliable and wonderful and brilliant people, but are all, at the end of the day, individual human beings. So we're treating these systems as though they are pure robots who are making purely ethical decisions at all point in time. It's all human thinking that's going into it. That's what worries me of thinking through what are the assumptions that I am not already myself worried about that they may be building in that I'm not okay with. Aaron, what is your worry?
I have many worries, and they also come from having worked with a lot of engineers. But I think that zooming out from it, my main worry might be that we don't have systems for machine accountability. Right. So if we Lauren and I have both worked with the military, I spent a year in Afghanistan and worked with forces from the United States and a variety of other countries there. We don't really have a sense of what if a machine makes a mistake in targeting what the due process or punishments might be for that. Should it be the person who wrote the original code? Should it be the people who inputted the maps? Should it, you know, where how do we create a framework for holding machines accountable for mistakes? And I think that that's, you sort of take Lauren's point of departure about limited frames of reference or kind of narrow viewpoints, bake that into a very sophisticated weapon system, there will be mistakes. There'll be unintended consequences. And as we said before, militaries are control freaks. We have a way of dealing with the human element of that. We've evolved that over time. We have lots of training and you know, sort of punishment mechanisms to hold folks to account. My worry is that we don't have a way to do that on the machine side. And as a democracy, I find that really troubling.
I have one more that applies to some of the other topics we're going to talk about too. So both Aaron and I have worked with senior levels of government and actually many other levels of government as well. Many of the senior officials that I have worked with have such low levels of technical sophistication mm-hmm. on things mm-hmm. as basic as email or social media, passwords, why you change them, you know, cybersecurity issues, that they purely just don't understand things that are fairly natural, instinctive to me. And understanding artificial intelligence, autonomous systems, these are things that are hard for me already. When you're putting these kinds of technological capabilities in the hands of senior-level officials that frankly don't understand them and have limited capacity and sometimes interest to understand them as well, that worries me a lot. What is our leadership training system going to be for officials coming into these roles, particularly in the future 10 years out, where it's going to be a degree of difficulty to really kind of train yourself on what does this mean, how do these operate? I worry about a world where I had a boss that didn't want to log into email at all, trying to explain to them how does artificial intelligence play into an autonomous drone in some way, and then having perhaps a level of trust in it that may not necessarily be warranted.
You have to pass messages about the autonomous drones on napkins with crayon so that they can actually look at them.
There's actually there was at one point in time a comic that was drawn to explain why backdoors into encrypted systems don't work very well, that was handed around, I'll just say, a very high level of government in order to explain to senior officials of how encryption actually works. And that worked to explain, but that took actually a lot of work in order to explain to these officials, here's this comic here's how encryption works and here's how it doesn't work.
But just going back to Aaron, your point about accountability, I mean, what's the implication of that? Because you could therefore argue that fundamentally, you can't really delegate decision-making because accountability is always therefore going to be a complete mess. And you have to do what, I mean, I think Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and a host of other scientists wrote an open letter in 2015 saying that there should be a ban on autonomous weapons. I'm just interested in your view on the public policy implications of that accountability deficit.
Yeah, I think that maybe it gets to the point that this isn't a technology question and shouldn't be just a question of technical capability or technical capacity, but instead kind of drawing on Lauren's point, It's a fundamentally political decision, right? The idea that you would, whether we're talking about a missile defense system, whether we're talking about an armed autonomous drone, whether we're talking about undersea or land warfare capabilities, that has to be part of a robust debate of the civilian political leadership, not just kind of mad scientists somewhere deep in a military service or an intelligence agency. And obviously, on the one hand, we do sometimes have those big debates within the civilian apparatus. But as Lauren kind of highlighted, it can be an unequal playing field in terms of whether, you know, classification issues aside, just the technical knowledge is not evenly distributed through our institutions. So, you know, my push would be, if we think that these systems are necessary to, you know, defend the nation, secure American or other national interests, you know, that needs to be part of a public debate about how we think about these systems. And then part of a professionalization effort within the services or the intelligence agencies. You know, we do have ways of incorporating new technologies and new concepts of operations. We aren't just locked into, you know, how we did things in 1950 or 1850. But that needs to be part of it. So it's not just that you can buy a new weapon system and test it and deploy it, but that you actually need to have not just the training, but also the legal and other kind of accountability mechanisms that come along with it. And that means that you need engineers and lawyers and philosophers and a whole bunch of other people involved in that process.
Can I be just the humanitarian in the room making the case for autonomous vehicle or autonomous weapons for a second? I think humans are terrible. I think humans make awful mistakes in conflict all the time and end up killing tons of civilians. And not that this is the kind of overarching argument for autonomous weapons, but to the question about how do we identify what our value sets are, you could imagine value sets being coded to protect international humanitarian law and reduce civilian deaths and in a way become, you know, more precise and reduce some of the collateral that we're concerned about when awful human beings are at the helm. And so how do you think about that when you're thinking about autonomous weapons?
So I tend to think of more in terms of what the Department of Defense was partnering with Google on as of last year. I guess they're no longer actually partnering with Google on this for Project Maven, which is more of an artificial intelligence application where they were looking at they weren't even going so far as to saying we want to, you know, have the weapons itself, the, you know, the use of kinetic force itself be autonomous, but more that we wanted the analytic capacity to say, wow, those are definitely civilians. Do not target them. They effectively wanted to be able to use artificial intelligence to say, please do not target kindergartens or kids or campfires or things that are clearly civilian in nature. Those, to me, and that kind of goes back, and we were talking about where artificial intelligence and to some degree autonomous systems, not weapons, can be used to say, don't act. Don't act as against these things. Where humans may be a valuable interface to say, go ahead and act. One reason that I find humans to be a valuable factor in any of these decisions is that as much as we can use artificial intelligence, machine learning, to integrate those in autonomous systems to choose targets, to be have them more in line with our values, adversaries can just as easily understand how we're going to implement those systems and try to start camouflaging their own targets. By which I mean, if people start to guess that we think that a target looks like this, they're always wearing green and always using these kinds of buildings and this kind of activity, they'll start behaving differently. Or they'll start encouraging non-targets to use those behaviors. So it becomes really, really hard to identify what are the things that we actually want to strike in any capacity.
And of course, so they do that with like the human red target list already.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Human shields and hospitals and all of that.
Yeah.
Didn't Google in 2017 develop an adversarial image patch that could trick machine learning systems into identifying a banana as a toaster? I think I read that somewhere.
That sounds dangerous.
Yes. So as much as we would really love to be able to say that humans will bring a degree of perfection and precision into warfare in the future, that's absolutely true. But our adversaries will be as equally cognizant of that and be working to fight against that in as many ways as we are working to create that level of precision and perfection.
We're going to take a quick break and be back soon with more from the Bombshell crew.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
And we're back with Lauren DeJong-Schulman and Aaron Simpson.
Our conversation has bled from kind of autonomous weapons into artificial intelligence, and they obviously have a lot of kind of intersecting points. But to pick up on kind of artificial intelligence and particularly some of this prediction pieces, when you're looking at the technological advances that are being made, do you think that there are substantial steps to reducing error and bias in those types of process? Because I think you could, you know, look back historically at the nature of warfare, and there's always an incentive to camouflage, an incentive to misrepresent, and that these are, you know, the fundamental games that are happening within conflict all the time, and that it's just kind of the new technology, the new platform that that then plays out on. And so I guess the question is there something fundamentally different about the way that artificial intelligence is reducing error and bias and actually kind of piercing through some of those games?
I mean, certainly it has the opportunity to do that. And I think that, you know, we're right to point out, you know, anybody who's read, you know, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, or has read through kind of normal human cognitive biases knows that humans don't make perfect decisions. You know, we have recency bias. We have all kinds of blinders that, you know, prevent us from making optimal decisions. And we have some catastrophic outputs of that, whether it's groupthink or, you know, misidentified targets or other sorts of things. What's interesting, I think, to think about, and this is part of why the intelligence community at least has focused on kind of human-machine teaming, is what are those skills or what are those applications that machines are particularly good at where they can reduce human bias? And then what are those sorts of decisions or sets of trade spaces where human judgment actually is really deeply necessary and would be really difficult to replicate in a machine setting, right? So even for as good as machines are at image processing, they still get some really, really fundamental things sort of wrong. And we have these, you know, great examples of adversarial AI where, you know, you can't tell the difference between, you know, dogs and wolves because it turns out all the wolves had snow in the background and the machine had just optimized on the mountains and not on the actual features of the thing that the human was looking at. Those are things I think we can work on kind of over time. And this is actually one place where I'm usually fairly cynical or at least skeptical of, you know, our procurement processes in the U.S. government. It's really hard for us to buy new technology. But one of the things we do is we test things, like, a lot. And so the sorts of things that might get you through a Silicon Valley pitch deck or might get you investment funding from a venture capital fund are not going to cut it when it comes to actually being used, you know, at Special Operations Command or by a unit of deployed Marines. And these are things that if they work, people will adopt them. And if they don't, they will junk them. And somebody might have paid a lot of money for it, but it will never actually get used. And so the levels of reliability and accuracy that are demanded of these systems, whether on the analysis side or on actual, you know, deployed autonomous weapons, is so high that it's almost, you could make the argument that we're going to be slow to adopt and slower than many of our adversaries because we have such high expectations of their performance.
We're going to move on to cyber warfare in one second. I just want to ask one final question on autonomous weapons, which is how you think it will actually change the practice of war. And I think if there's one thing that I worry about is that you'll see the cost of war dramatically lower. And as a result, the disincentive to essentially not keep wars going on for a very, very long time to achieve strategic interests will not be there. So how do you think that autonomous weapons will tempt governments to just engage in permanent warfares of containment?
So, I mean, this is effectively what we are seeing already with the present war on terror, which has changed drastically from one where we are deploying hundreds of thousands of troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to one where we have kind of pockets of forces all over the globe with the reliance on drone systems, which are not in themselves autonomous, but have the ability to deploy unmanned over long distances. And a lot of that is sort of less a problem with the nature of the warfare itself, which could be arguably in some cases more effective, or I don't want to, well, that's probably exaggerating a bit, effective in some cases. It's more of a political problem, going back to some of our points earlier, where it's quite convenient for politicians to have these smaller deployments, these more technology-driven deployments that are less risky to U.S. personnel, because they don't have to talk about them with the American people very much. The cost is not apparent. It's interesting. There was analysis by Sarah Krebs over the last year. She wrote a really good book, effectively saying that we will not see Americans change their perspective on the utility of the war on terror with a lot of swing until they are effectively taxed, or they see the price of war go up for them in some way, having nothing to do with how many people are dying or whether or not their brothers and sisters are in the war. But it all comes down to pocketbook. But to me, I think that there's also a political obligation within that of having U.S. politicians talk significantly more about where we are engaged in these fights, which is already something that they're not terribly interested in talking about on a day-to-day basis.
So to pull up on that, when you then kind of look 10, 20 years out and you're thinking about some of these technological shifts that are happening, do you then just think we end up in an equilibrium of a lot of kind of perpetual conflicts that are happening globally that essentially haven't made the radar, rather than kind of big conflicts that are on front pages that you see day to day?
So one, I guess
– you can make the argument that we're there already.
Yeah, I think we're there already. One and potentially interesting addition to that is the proliferation of sensors all over the world, non-military public sensors, which are in many cases just human beings, who are seeing the impact of war on the ground and broadcasting that much more so than they would have been able to do even 10 years ago. So I certainly think that is an absolute risk and something that I would worry about and want to put a lot of policy energy into. I think there is also going to be the potential for publics globally to be able to talk more about, publicize, put on the internet how these conflicts are impacting them and their daily lives, as well as their economy, as well as the global economy, in ways that were not as apparent 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
What a perfect note to transition to cyber war on.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
So that gets to kind of a fundamental question that I think about a lot, which is cyber war tends to be one of the kind of evolving technologies and strategies that you can very much more easily obtain, because it doesn't necessarily require hardware and that could have huge impact. So you could plan a cyber attack on an electricity grid that takes out multiple states. How do you think about the ways in which cyber war is potentially more captured by or kind of favors asymmetric warfare?
Oh, it's definitely asymmetric. But I always try to think about cyber warfare, in terms of, to what end, right? So if you're just a chaos muppet and you just want to like rake, mayhem across the international system, cyber's a pretty good tool for that. I mean, like if you watched Fight Club too many times, like this is a pretty good, application for that.
If Fight Club was done today, right, they would have used cyber war.
Absolutely.
In terms of like an actual tool of international policy or as an effort to accomplish your political ends, it's actually still pretty complicated. And in those situations, cyber warfare looks a lot like traditional espionage or subversion, just with an additional kind of means of entry, as opposed to having to recruit someone or turn an operative or recruit, a small local force. You're able to access those kind of critical points remotely. There definitely are instances where I think there have been some pretty sophisticated cyber efforts. The Chinese are definitely pursuing this. Lauren knows I was sort of captivated by this Marriott hack that got revealed just before Christmas, and the ways in which we suspect Chinese security services are marrying the passport data they have from Marriott reservations with the information they already obtained by hacking the U.S. personnel systems for clearance holders. They're looking not just for U.S. spies, but the other people staying in hotels the same times as their suspected U.S. spies, because those would be Chinese spies. And they actually care a lot more about those than ours. So some of these things are not just like, oh, we're going to launch a war with the cyber, but like we're going to execute really traditional counterintelligence functions with these pretty sophisticated data sweeps, and you're going to have a hard time stopping it. That's what kind of gives me pause more so than, I don't know, something that you might see out of Black Mirror.
And do you see cyber war as a substitute for traditional warfare or traditional means of subversion, and therefore in some ways either a neutral or positive trend? Or do you think it can end up being a complement to or even a trigger for traditional war, particularly potentially due to a miscalculation?
I think it really depends on who you're talking to. The Department of Defense and people in the defense community over the last 20 years or so have not been terribly good, though have certainly gotten better at lifting their sights between from, you know, cyber war is just like cyber against cyber. We cyber systems are targeting your cyber systems, and keeping it fairly narrowly constrained to mostly national security defense oriented matters, to what it really is, which tends to be what Aaron just talked about, maybe targeting financial systems, maybe targeting hotel records of some kind, things that we don't have as natural defenses for, nor do we necessarily have a good understanding of like where does that fit into our overall continuum of risk and threat. You know, if the Chinese hack the Marriott and ultimately in 20 years we could see that has a really major national security impact, should we have responded more forcefully 20 years ago? Or should we have just let that kind of gradually escalate over a period of time? I think we are still figuring out as a national security system, how is it that cyber fits into our conception of, you know, what goes next on the ladder? You did this to us, we do this to you. Is it just cyber to cyber? Is it other tools like we're using sanctions and indictments and other matters right now? And is this something that we should be considering purely on a state-to-state basis or much more on a private actor kind of proxy basis, which makes things much more complicated?
But presumably, if the cyber attack had massive human suffering implications, such as taking out a whole grid and downing hospitals, etc., the response is likely to bleed over way beyond cyber.
Or maybe just to pull in there, right? Like if the Marriott breach allows the Chinese government to basically attach the IDs and kind of generate information and then further target people who are a part of intelligence, like that could get pretty violent really quickly.
Oh, and I think it has internally within China. I mean, the reporting on that is obviously spotty, but there's been not so much directed toward U.S. persons, but definite roll-ups of suspected Chinese agents as a result of those kind of data exploitation efforts. I guess I'm certainly, if there was like a large scale infrastructure attack, that would, I think, be seen as an act of war in a sense. Although clearly a lot of what's going on in the cyber realm is a desire to avoid attribution, to kind of work in this, you know, gray zone between formal declared military policy and, you know, kind of criminal action, right? So you have everything from the Sony hacks to Russian hacking of, you know, U.S. Elections. Not the election, you know, they're not hacking U.S. government systems, right? They're hacking, you know, they're doing influence operations in social media. They're hacking and then releasing strategically private emails as a way of kind of pulsing the system. So I think that these things are designed to try to avoid the responses that you guys are concerned about, right? Which is they're trying to, you know, stay below the threshold of certainly large-scale military response and maybe even below the threshold of large-scale diplomatic response, although they don't always get that calibration quite right. But it requires, you know, a law enforcement system and an intelligence system that's functional that can make that level of attribution and then make the public case about it without burning sources and methods. And that's pretty tricky. And so, I mean, this is the kind of murky space that we're working in, partially because they are trying to avoid all the really high-end sophisticated weapons we talked about before. This is a way, as you guys noted, on the cheap to exert a great deal of political influence or at least to subvert an existing system without having to expose yourself or your political partners to a lot of risk.
I mean, this is something that the United States and its allies have gotten a little better at over the last couple of years, is that the willingness, if not the ability, has possibly been there, but certainly the willingness to publicly say, we think this country did this. And to have a group of nations say that with them all at one time is perhaps more impactful than just having the United States intelligence community leak it in some way. And to be able to pair that with sanctions as well as indictments I mean, those may not actually look as though they're having a lot of real impact on behavior. Where I think it's interesting to focus on this is whether it has impact on the ability of maybe, say, the Chinese, the Russians, or others to recruit talent. Because if the United States has identified, like, well, we think this hacker or this group of people had something to do with the Marriott hack or something else, and they are no longer allowed to travel to the United States, or they're not allowed to buy U.S. stuff or use U.S. financial systems, that could be a real deterrent to young people who might otherwise be interested in pursuing that kind of career in China or Russia or elsewhere. That's going to be really hard to say immediately. I think that's something we'd have to study over a long period of time, whether or not that does have impact. But I think that kind of goes back to all of these capabilities have people on the back end of them that you need to care about, whether or not they're interested, willing, and able to pursue the kind of careers that allow us to utilize these capabilities.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back soon with more from the Bombshell crew. And we're back with Lauren DeJong-Schulman and Aaron Simpson, two of the three co-hosts of Bombshell. Taking a step out of this and looking more broadly at the private sector, I'd love to understand how you think the private sector should be engaging around these types of products with respect to the Department of Defense and government. And one of the things I think about is the fact that I think during the Cold War, there was a much larger driving force in U.S. government investment in technological innovations that led to things like GPS and, you know, the beta version of the internet. Whereas today, you kind of see an inverse where private sector is really making a lot of the advances. And I think, you know, according to like a 2016 McKinsey study, private sector invested 10 times in artificial intelligence, unclassified artificial intelligence compared to the U.S. government. And increasingly, as kind of we were noting before, a number of prominent tech firms are kind of signing on that they're not going to support the U.S. government in or support governments that are kind of engaging in defense-oriented projects. And so we'd love to hear how we should think about the role of the private sector as these new technologies come on board and kind of change the nature of war.
There's a lot to unpack in that. I'll mention a couple of points and let Aaron weigh in as well. So I think that we should distinguish between the companies, the technology companies themselves and their workforces, which are an interesting political force. I think companies themselves, whether or not they publicize this or not, are a lot more willing to work with the defense sector than we might assume from the headlines. There's a lot more partnership that goes on, perhaps behind closed doors and other kinds of like subcontracts than you might necessarily suspect, given the amount of public pushback that we have seen on issues like Project Maven. Now, whether or not you have a workforce who is willing to work on some of these projects is questionable, but I think that there is still a large enough market of people that really, really want to work in these sectors that you're always, at the end of the day, probably going to have people who are willing to work on things if they're not – they don't become terribly publicly controversial. Now, going over the defense side, something I worry about that even if you have, you know, even if Google and Apple and Amazon and all of the, you know, most brilliant technology minds in the world were happily willing to open their doors and say, please take all of our knowledge, please work with us, and we will partner with you to give us all the amazing things we can do so you can do war better. DoD is not really good at buying software. In fact, they're quite terrible at it. And they're really, really bad at it when they're buying non-proprietary software.
And you're saying they're not even checking their emails.
Yeah, exactly. Where the software itself may be at least partially open source or shared more publicly than DoD is usually used to buying. So even if Silicon Valley was willing to work, you know, hand in glove with the Department of Defense, DoD, for all of its speeches and outreach and the Defense Innovation Unit, is still really working out how is it exactly that we incorporate some of this innovation and ingenuity and the kind of best technology minds that you see in the world into our decision-making and processes and systems. And this is where Aaron can have a little more insight.
Well, I have a totally retrograde opinion on the partnership piece, which is that I think the Defense Department should go hell for leather for bringing this in-house. And they should stop trying to acquire commercial technology and buy it off the shelf. I think there's real limitations to what generic, you know, AI optimization is going to give you for targeting in a weapon system in the first place. And they should, you know, find ways to bring in top talent. You know, we mentioned before the amount of money that we used to spend, you know, internal to the U.S. government. That's because those people were all working in U.S. government labs and were U.S. government employees. I mean, some of them were certainly at academic universities or they were at Bell Labs or whatever. But
that was the place to work if you wanted to work on those issues.
Exactly. And so I just sort of think that, like, if you're serious about this, you'll, you know, legalize marijuana, allow those people to get clearances and bring them all in-house and find ways to pay them. And if you're not serious about it, you won't do those things.
Beanbags and fresh coconut water for everybody.
Right. Exactly. Well, my addition to that is that if DOD was really, really serious about this, they would go on a super high-level push for recruiting women with computer science and other technology-related degrees. If there is as much of a pushback in hiring women of high talent into the technology sector, particularly in Silicon Valley, then there are other places that would very happily use those talents. And, you know, DOD is not really open for business right now. So if they could open the doors a little wider, they might have some luck.
Taking advantage of, like, the stereotyping and prejudice that we know are rampant in Silicon Valley and try to invert that for the Department of Defense's favor.
Yep. You know, but the other place that we can think about, you know, if AI is, in fact, an underlying technology, an enabling technology like the combustion engine, you know, it wasn't national militaries that invented the car. They might have invented the tank, but that was a really specific application of an existing set of technologies. And so I think, you know, certainly the private sector is going to have incredible advances on data analytics and artificial intelligence and even potentially, you know, self-driving cars or other applications in those spaces. I'm kind of, I don't know, I guess a kind of a skeptic of, like, the AI revolution is here and it's going to impact militaries right now. It's going to take a while for these things to really work their way through not just military innovation, but through societies and through economies. And there's a lot of opportunity to shift the balance of power that have nothing to do with how the Defense Department buys software.
And on that note of AI skepticism, I actually want to put it back to the kind of humanitarian angle, because if you really think about because, you know, when you think about how people have died in the last 10, 20 years in the context we work, it's been very, very ultra low tech. It's been you know, hospitals being bombed. It's homes being burnt down. It's blockading ports. It's scorched earth tactics in South Sudan. To what extent do you think in the next sort of 10 or 20 years, and I'd be interested to know what kind of timescale you think this might change in, will it really be about low-tech warfare? And when, if ever, will some of the things that we've been talking about really start to have a bearing on large-scale human suffering that therefore humanitarians will need to start thinking about how they deal with?
That's a good question. I mean, I think in the near term, you know, there's also questions about, you know, people also die from having dirty water. Right, and having insufficient access to health resources. And so to the extent that any of these underlying technologies are able to transform economies or societies in a way that make any of that more equitable, I hope that has some positive humanitarian implications. I mean,
that's why actually where I think that cyber is quite interesting, because fundamentally it could be about breaking the civilian infrastructure systems, and therefore you have to think about how you respond. And it's not dissimilar to the kind of response we have to do when, you know, the state breaks down in the midst of conflicts.
Yeah, and it could be the case then that, you know, you build systems, you know, going forward that are much more decentralized and much more resilient, and not like one dam that screwed up the water supply for a whole country, and then if it breaks, screws up, you know, the rest of everything else, right? That you have a more decentralized and potentially accountable set of systems. That's as optimistic as you're ever going to hear me, you know, say. I think that there's, you know, there's some other options. I'm not a China skeptic in terms of thinking that, like, China is not a rising power or that they aren't very sophisticated. I just sort of think that deterrence kind of works. And so I don't expect there to be a really huge great power conflict where we're going to kill 20 million people again. I mean, I hope I'm right. But it's one of those things where these weapon systems could all evolve and we could have these other sophisticated elements, but it's, I don't know. I feel like states have at times kind of chosen to walk back from the brink when they found something that they – the destructive power of which they find unsettling.
So the other side of that comment, Aaron, that I think a lot about right now, I did over a couple of years a lot of study on drones and how – in particular how senior policymakers really did not understand what – precision in terms of munitions really meant. And that they had this image in their mind of more what you see in the Hollywood of like a missile specifically targeting only the one bad guy and leaving everyone else unscathed. And that was really a strong, a really difficult mental image to combat for a lot of senior policymakers, to be able to show them some of the images and the stories that come back from humanitarians on the ground as well as news organizations and others to say, look, this view you have of this really incredible technology is not as precise and as good as you think it is. And therefore, you need to change your assumptions about how you're using it. That's something I worry about with the systems we're talking about right now in terms of cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and other things, that it will take a long time to integrate, and that's natural and probably a good thing in many ways. But policymakers who are not well-versed on it may overassume how good and how impactful it is and possibly how many lives it could possibly save. And it's not to say that, you know, these are bad things and we should never, ever do them, but more that skepticism of how good they actually are needs to be consistent and brought up frequently with senior-level decision-makers as much as we can.
So as a last question, I think it follows nicely from that, which is, what are the ways in which any of these new technologies are generating a focus on things that are ultimately positive? And what I'm kind of taking from, or what I'm thinking about there is, Lauren, in some of your work on drones, you talked about how drones started generating real-time information and how mm-hmm. then everybody started focusing on real-time information and demanding real-time information, and that actually everything became kind of renormed around that specific type of information, when in reality, it actually wasn't that useful.
Yep.
And so taking a step back and looking at these new technologies, are there ways in which any of these things are happening and it's actually making us focus on something that's more important or that ultimately is going to reduce the probability of conflict or the severity of it in a way that makes you optimistic?
Hmm. This is where we're missing Radha. She's our optimist.
Yeah.
That is not the role that we tend to
and
to
silence.
Play.
It's going to be a great end to this podcast. Give us some hope. Well, I can't.
I have one. This is an admittedly odd answer to your question, but I extremely rarely hear defense analysts ever talk about social security, healthcare, overall benefit systems, and social safety nets that a society provides its people, ever, because that's just not their business. They don't really care about it. I have oddly, in the last several artificial intelligence and autonomous systems papers that I have read, there's always been like some kind of like text box or something else on universal basic income as it relates to how artificial intelligence may ultimately change our overall economies and shift where jobs go to different kinds of people and ultimately possibly take a lot of jobs away. That is not something, I will be honest, that most defense analysts ever care about, ever. It's just not really in their bailiwick and not something that they focus on. But as a result of that has led to some interesting conversations and thinking amongst my peers about, okay, as our economies are changing, not purely because of technology, but that is amongst those issues, how is it that we should be thinking about providing a better safety net beneath those, how it may that it may impact in adverse ways? And, you know, that's probably not going to change the world. But for folks who are normally kind of focused on how better can we kill people or prevent ourselves from being killed, it's not the worst outcome on the planet. And again, I apologize, that's probably not the most optimistic answer you could offer, but it's better than nothing. Aaron, help me.
I mean, I can think of one application space that could be kind of interesting, which is that as sensors become more ubiquitous and therefore more accessible and affordable, you might be able to have, instead of having like a classified U.S. missile warning system, something that, in fact, the United Nations put up or a consortium of states. And they would then say, look, we will all have awareness if there's some sort of missile launch. And we agree to this set of principles, you know, around that. And so it would not be a proprietary limited sort of thing, but in fact, would kind of democratize certain kinds of protection. You could imagine that around maybe anti-submarine warfare, other kinds of disaster detection.
Mm-hmm. That's a
most
great one.
Of what we do with regard to tsunami warning is actually based on U.S. sensors. When they fail or when local systems fail, like in Indonesia, then you have catastrophic consequences. And so there might be opportunities, whether for NGOs or international governmental organizations or other consortiums of public and private actors, to engage with these systems, put up their own, and provide some kind of common good that individual states are not able to do on their – or unwilling to do on their own. So I think that there is some upside to the ubiquitous sensor piece of things. But that's going to take a lot of coordination, a lot of kind of shared governance norms that are tough to sustain over time. It's going to require a lot of work.
From killer robots to universal basic income, I never thought we'd cover that much ground. Lauren and Aaron, thank you so much for being on Displaced.
Thank you for having us.
That was Lauren DeJong-Schulman and Aaron Simpson of the Bombshell Podcast. If you want more on any of the topics we discussed on this episode today, check out our show notes on www.rescue.org/displaced.
Next week, we are talking with Yemeni activist Radia Al-Mutawakkil. Radia is the chairperson and co-founder of the Muatana Organization for Human Rights, which documents human rights violations in Yemen. 2 weeks ago, you heard from Rob Malley at the International Crisis Group that Yemen was one of the number one conflicts to watch for in 2019. Now we actually want to hear from somebody who is working on the ground to address it and build accountability.
If you want to get in touch with us, email us at displaced@rescue.org. Talk to us on Twitter.
I'm at Grant M. Gordon.
And I'm at Argramurthy.
Another way you can let us know how much you love the show and the conversations we're having is to rate and review Displaced on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends and fellow techies about us.
At Vox Media, Displaced is produced by Megan Cunane. Our engineer is Jelani Carter, with extra help this week from Michael Franz. Golda Arthur is our senior producer.
I haven't seen her recently because all she's doing is going out and getting string cheese. That's all she does. Anna Shakura is the executive producer of audio. At the IRC, a shout out to Anna Feuer, who is our researcher, and a special thanks to Alex Bandea, Natalie Sarkowski, and Ben Moskowitz. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.